Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers. And today I'm speaking to you from the office of the Schumacher College at Dargington Hall in southern western England, where they have a college for new economists, and they're having a course on sustainable agriculture, and it's very beautiful. And I'm very happy and thankful to be speaking with an incredible entrepreneur from Texas, from Cat Springs, who has brought a product to market from the native flora of her region. And I met her at the Social Venture Network, where she was going to catch that social investment dollar to build her business. Welcome. Hello.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Jardy, will you tell about what you're doing and how you got started and where you are in the world?
Sure thing. We're at the beginning of reintroducing a delicious beverage back into the marketplace. It's something that grows wild in our part of Texas, and it's a native plant that's caffeinated. And it's something that's been overlooked for the past couple centuries as a commercial product, and we found out about it in 2011. So I grew up around this plant, but I didn't know that it was something that you could steep like a tea until very recently.
Well, so basically you're making dried tea and you're bagging it and you're selling it to restaurants for iced tea and for hot tea, and it has a lot of, I'm sure, properties that you'll tell us more about. you want to just start from the beginning? Like, how did you learn about the tea, and how did you decide to go into business?
Great. Yes, yeah, so the drought of 2011 was the worst in Texas history, and we just watched a lot of established trees and plants suffer and die, but this plant, Gilpon, just took it all in stride, and so that's when I started to research what was it used for. I mean, it's a perfect crop. It's very abundant in this part of Texas, and it would be great if there was a use for it. And so that's when I found research by the University of Florida and Texas A&M on its properties that it's very beneficial for the human body. And then I found a lot of research that was really historical eyewitness accounts of Native Americans consuming it as a daily ritual. And the explorers who were able to experience drinking this tea with them in the mornings. And so it was just really interesting that it was something that had fallen out of habit in this part of the world. And
Well, can I interrupt for a second? Because yeah, I feel like there's a whole bunch of that economic botany that was being studied, and the potential of plants were being super investigated as part of natural history, as part of inquiry, as part of nation building, as part of Lewis and Clark, as part of botanic gardens and early naturalists. Mm-hmm. And there was so much exploration of potential economic uses for weed plants, especially because, you know, we were like, let's grow the stuff that wants to grow.
Right.
So I guess the question is, where, under what tabs were you looking? I guess you could just look for the species name, huh?
Right. And I think that's the most interesting thing about this plant's history, is that it's much maligned in that early exploration period, because it was something that was a potential direct competitor to really expensive imported tea, mm-hmm. from Camellia sinensis. And so if you see the scientific name of Gilpon, it's Ilex vomitoria, and that's a misnomer. It comes from the tea, the Gilpon, being used as a base in spiritual purification ceremonies, but it itself is not emetic. It was added to something else to encourage vomiting, or the native groups that drank it needed they equated spiritual purity and physical purity. And so it was kind of a scare tactic to discourage new colonists from drinking Gilpon when it was a viable substitute for really expensive imported tea from Asia and India.
Wow. And so, okay, so you discovered that this plant doesn't die. Then you discovered that it's not poisonous and, in fact, is healthy. Then you discovered that you were going to do this. And then how did you go about convincing chefs to buy something and serve something completely new? Like, what has been your approach?
It's very grassroots. The thing that's just really fantastic about this plant is that it tastes so good. It's a really smooth, clean taste, and it tastes like tea. And so it's really selling itself as we make it available and explain the benefits and this clean, not bitter tea taste. And the local food movement has really embraced it, especially in Austin. And then we have folks who are buying tea for hot or iced tea all across the country through our website and through our Amazon Prime storefront. So,
and people are then recognizing, I mean, here's a question, like, mm-hmm. when people say, oh, tea from here, does it provoke the question like, oh, you know, tea and coffee are both products that are massively related to empire, exploitation of labor, plantations of monocultures of poison, and a small number of companies that dominate the marketplace and extract the majority of the profit from the supply chain. I mean, do people make that connection? Do you talk about that, or is that just kind of like not even a part of your shtick?
It's really not a part of the information that we are putting forward. It definitely is part of the dialogue. It's something that comes up a lot when people are price sensitive to what we're doing, because this is a product that is American grown and it's American labor from, you know, point one all the way through. And that's something that we're really proud of. It's creating jobs and it's making our local economy look different. And that's something that's great, because a lot of positions in rural areas are very lacking in any kind of, it's a very limited amount of jobs out here in Austin County. So it's something that's very interesting to talk to people about, because the average consumer isn't very aware of where their food comes from, much less the economies of scale and the unfairness that can be involved in creating their food.
So what, in the ideal situation, how does this new food product kind of play out in the marketplace? I mean, I know that with other wild harvested plants like white sage, there's been some drama where there's over harvesting, and there's now conversations about, you know, what's that maca of the birch called again? Chaga. Mm-hmm. And obviously the wild harvest of ginseng has been a problem. But my first question is it possible to over-harvest yacon? What are the possibilities and what are the dangers?
Right. We've spoken with a lot of sustainability experts because it's such a novel situation. It's a plant that's considered to be an invasive native. And from the historical use of the land, what we're seeing is that what used to be post-oak savanna or open grassland in the deep south was farmed, and then the native grasses were disturbed or displaced. And so this is one of the flora that's response was to grow in an area that it hadn't grown before, and so it's invading. And so that's really interesting, because it's different than something fragile like ginseng that can't be disturbed so that it can continue its growth and not be over-harvested. It's really in a different category, because it's something that needs to be manicured's a funny word, most people say beat back, like, please come take it out. And it gives us the opportunity for reharvesting because it's a very tenacious plant. And so the aspects of sustainability that we observe are not harvesting during certain nesting seasons and watching out for endangered bird species. But as far as taking the plant either down to the ground or harvesting higher on the plant by pruning it, it's not something that is risky. So that's really been interesting because.
And what about your business? I mean, you guys are out there, you know, inviting people to try something new. Mm-hmm. And doing all the market research and figuring out how to dry it probably and how to bag it probably and how to sell it. And then are you worried about another company coming in and just making it cheaper and bigger? And what's that? How do you think about that?
That's a fantastic question. It's a very real danger for what we're doing, because we're pioneering bringing this product to the market. And somebody bigger, stronger, faster could come in. But the thing that we have just really been delighted about, my sister and I, as we built this company, is that folks really understand the story of the product and the Cat Spring Yaupon is a really high quality product, and that's going to be our staying power.
So wait a minute, we just skipped over something super important, which is this is a sister and sister business.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what you guys were doing with your lives? And then, you know, I mean, if my sister came to me and said, we're going to sell a shrub as tea, I don't know that it would necessarily convince me to move back to my hometown. So you guys must have very special. How did that go?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was over a year because she lived out of state. She was in Washington, D.C., and I was sending her samples of what I was doing, and she was interested. She was working, she had worked as a CPA, and then she was working as a community liaison for Lululemon and Athletica in D.C., and so as she was working on her MBA in entrepreneurship, I was working on how to prepare Yaupon so that it was really tasty, because the plant grows wild where we grew up, but there has been just really loss of how to prepare it. And so I think that the turning point where she got really interested and was telling me, this could be an industry, Jenity, we really need to talk about working together and making a business out of this, because I was just thinking farmers markets and reintroduce the local food, was that we saw the employment piece could be something that was high value and not low value and high overturns. And that was something that we both really wanted to be a part of, to create a better community than what we grew up around. And this was just a fantastic part of the country, and the folks in Cat Spring and surrounding areas really support our workers, and we have a production facility outside of Houston in Katy, and it's been really neat to see the community there come around this new product and also enhance the lives of the women and men who work with us. And so that it's almost a triple bottom line business, because this is a plant that needs to be harvested and maintained, so it's really beneficial to the local ecosystem here. And then being able to change people's lives because of the dignity of work is another bottom line. And, of course, we need to do this profitably, so that's our third bottom line.
And so if it goes really well and you succeed, what does that look like?
That's a great question. This could be something that's popular, like yerba mate, not only in its growing region, but internationally. And, I mean, really the sky's the limit. There's so much available. Creating a high-quality product is something that we're very dedicated to at Cat Spring Yaupon, and it's something that can just continue to gain momentum. The taste is what's driving it, and that's what's exciting. We're not telling people, drink this, it's good for you, and they have to choke it down. It's almost a sweet tea without having to have sweeteners added to it.
Well, I think that is a very viable possibility. I mean, you know, and then, of course, the food culture catches up. The example that jumps to my mind is that in Louisiana, they still have that beignet chicory coffee thing going on. They got a little fetish for the taste of the coffee substitute that they made. Well, now, why did they have that? Because of embargo and the War of 1812? What's the history? We don't know. I don't know the history. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they started having chicory coffee.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a delight to see something local really take a foothold, and then people be able to experience Texas by drinking Yaupon no matter where they are.
I think this is a big thing for Texas. I feel like you got to get the Texas Department of Agriculture up on the... I think that actually the Texas Department of Agriculture was one of the first departments of agriculture to do organic certification within their ag department when Jim Hightower was there.
Uh-huh.
It might be, he's still there. be interesting to talk to him about it.
Yeah.
Well, here's another question. So last time I had the cranberry people that we met from that same conference, the Salvation Alley.
Salvation Alley.
And we were talking about, you know, so here we are, young people starting these food businesses, and how is it going, and what is the relationship that you can have with the investors? What do they need to hear? What are their kind of concerns or attitudes? And what kind of guidance do you have for other people who are putting themselves in the position of a business startup and needing to sing the right song, but also, you know, educate the investors to understand what this kind of a food business will mean?
Right. I wish Abby Ann was on the call, my co-founder and sister, because this is this is her strength, and it's not my wheelhouse. She's just done a really great job of working with investors who understand the risk of a food business, but that want a more sustainable future. And so I think that's something that's really been interesting that we've learned, is that it's not a very wide net. Because there's so much education involved on why what we're doing is different. And, because we're not building a restaurant. And and so we really are looking for a group of individuals who want to learn what we're doing and that are excited about all the different ways that doing a business differently could impact the community. And so she could speak so much more detailed to this, but I really appreciate the work that she's done talking to people about the company and finding groups of like-minded people who want to see us succeed, want to be part of it.
Well, and I mean, my experience, obviously, I come from a nonprofit family. I'm kind of clearly addicted to nonprofits. And you know, the thing about a nonprofit is, or any structure, you're making a family, and it sounds like, at least from the conversation I had with Salvation Alley, that the relationships that they're making with their investors really want to be more than just a money relationship, but also a team relationship, where those are people that are going to be looking out for your interests, committed, networking on your behalf, you know, assessing risks on your behalf, you know, scoping the competition, watching your back, protecting your reputation, finding other skill sets that are needed by the organization, and, you know, just being good peace workers, good holders of the light, to put it in Quaker terms.
Exactly. And I love what you're saying about how active a good investor is, because they're part of the team, and it's not kind of sitting back and observing a young company grow up. It's being part of it and getting their feet wet. I really like the way that you said that.
Yeah, and the question is that who is out there, or is it not? And how are we making really good relationships within the kind of capital space of our sustainable and regional food movement? And how is that relationship reciprocal and respectful and adapted to the actual market conditions, as opposed to trying to apply tech sector type expectations to the very slim margins that we all know about in food?
Right.
Because, you know, you make the site and then a gazillion people go clickety-clack and you make a margin on each clickety-clack. That's very different from bringing a refrigerated truck for every item.
Right.
And
right.
So just trying to translate across contexts between the clickety-clack world and the reefer truck world can sometimes lead us into a conflictual situation. But anyway, you don't have to reflect on that. I'm just speaking it aloud because I think it's a big part of the project that we're undertaking here together as a team in discerning and building these regional food businesses and the risk taking that's involved and the, you know, knuckle grease that's involved, or what's it called, elbow grease that's involved, is, you know, does require risk taking capital and patient capital. But that there are many benefits that come not only from what you guys are able to do with your business, but, you know, if this does become like the drink of Texas, the national drink of Texas, once it secedes, that's going to have a whole bunch of more impacts, and that you're, you know, the pioneer part of this is almost like a social investment.
Right. It really is. And I think you touched on something huge, is that it's patience, that this isn't something that couldn't be an overnight success. It's years and years of hard work and people coming around to a new flavor.
Well, it's hard because, you know, the problems are so big. I mean, we have this with Agrarian Trust. It's like there's 400 million acres of land changing hands in 20 years, and it's like, how are you going to scale to address the problem? And we're, you know, and we can't scale. There's no way, you know, that's the national, that's our public lands right there. That's the BLM, that's the Forest Service, you know, we are not able to, the problems are so big, and our solutions must of necessity be small, adaptive, related to place, based in relationship, and evolving in that context. And so I feel like it's important, as we're all doing this work, to be able to really clearly push back against and articulate forward along the lines of, you know, we're working on a solution that's relevant to our context here, in this place here, and before you go critiquing me for being small and beautiful, you know, maybe it needs to just happen. In so many, the points of origin for the new system must be profuse. Mm-hmm. Look at me. I'm starting to ministrate again. This is one of my problems when I drink too much tea. Is there anything you want to talk about your tea and how people can get it, or if that you need people to work for you, or anything about, you know, your guys' needs and thoughts or inspirations?
Well, I really appreciate that question. For me, on the production side of things, I'm always looking for new ideas of how to be more efficient in making the tea. And there's not a lot of machinery available stateside, and honestly, most of the tea is collected internationally, is done by hand. And so It's a really interesting engineering problem, and I love talking to people who have ideas or potential solutions, because we're always improving. I just really appreciate anybody reaching out with their ideas, because this is it's something that we're stewarding. It's not something that we own, and being able to reintroduce Yaupon through Cat Spring Yaupon is it's fantastic, because it belongs to everyone as an enjoyable product. So,
well, or mixing it in with other stuff. I mean, I just occurred to me, like,
oh, yeah.
Hey, you know, I just been drying all these elderflowers and linden blossoms and raspberry leaves and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Maybe we could have interregional herbal mixers.
Right, exactly. Blenders really love the Yaupon leaf, because it marries really well with a lot of different size particles and kind of holds a good structure. And then it's so mild that it's a nice body behind whatever other ingredients you're using. And so it's not competing in flavor, but really enhancing the beverage. So we love for people to experiment with it. We have folks making mead and kombucha, and, you know, other herbal teas, caffeinated teas, mixed drinks. It's a really fun product to work with.
Well, I really thank you for your time, and I think probably people will not hesitate to get in touch with you if they're interested. Yeah, please. And I hope that they're interested to get in touch with each other and ourselves and our moms. And, you know, don't get stuck in your email, everybody. Call people. And even if you haven't heard from somebody in a while, like, you know, maybe they fell into a love puddle. Maybe they have a broken heart. I just had, like, a really nice amount of random people phone calling stuff. And I was like, this is so old-fashioned. But since we're talking to a Texan, I figured I'd just bring it up. Let's call each other more.
That sounds perfect.
Nice talking to you. Thanks for being there.
It's great.
Thanks for doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you. Thank you for what you're doing, and I hope the rest of your trip's great.
Thank you kindly. All the best to everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.